Henry Lewis Horse Field Reel 3.
Ooh.
You were just telling me about the chicos about to catch the horse dung as it fell.
Yeah. The chicos used to help the fathers sweeping up. You see, when you get, I forget now how many to a batty, but what shall we estimate? I had 32 horses and mules under my charge. All those on the bombardier. I had all the battery staff, signallers, BCACs, and people like that. And the mules, of course, were used for drawing the ammunition limbers. So I had 32 horses and mules under my charge, whereas a sergeant, he'd have about 12 horses, guns, and the limber. So I had much more than them. So say, horses, say 50, say anything up to 100 horses in the lines there, and they were all mud stables. They took some keeping clean, and
So you had these chicos and sices to help you clean up the dung.
oh
Why did the chicos catch the dung? Why did they want to catch it?
yes, it saved them the trouble of sweeping up and having to cart it to the dump, didn't it? And it used to be a sort of a family affair with those people down there, because the babies used to be there as well. You see, you didn't have any brooms there; they were unsuitable anyhow, like you do at home. They're all made of rush brooms.
Like a witch's broom.
Yes, and they used to be quite happy. We weren't allowed to, any of this bullying business. There was a little bit of it went on, but not much. And if you were caught and brought up, you were severely punished for it too. Same as the cleaning boys and sizers. Some of them might have lost his money playing cards, and he didn't pay the cleaning boy this week, and because he was up in front of the sergeant, and if necessary, the sexton. Commander, and he had to cough up.
So the cleaning boys were not paid by the army. Were they paid by the troops themselves?
Yes.
So you were the troops themselves were really employing the servants.
That's right. You see, you get, I forget how many now, but you get one cleaning boy to so many men. Maybe, I forget now, maybe three, maybe half a dozen. All right, he got all the money from those. That was his wages. But the sizers and other employees with the farrier and that, they were officially employed, because I know, because they used to have to pay them out. And the way you paid them out was call their name out, took some pronouncing, some of them, and they come up, Sab, if you get all of his right thumb, put it on the ink pad and press it down in the appropriate place. So it's quite a time to pay them out.
How much did the sizes get paid? Can you
Oh, I
remember?
couldn't remember now, not much, only a few rupees a week. As I say, the average Indian like that, they were really poverty stricken. And yet, they were far better off than what the ordinary outside native was in the villages that. And I know from people who've come from there, Indians, well-educated ones, school teacher for a start off, told us when we gave up India, Lord Louis Mountbatten handed it over, there was quite a few sad hearts in India, because I'll say it myself, all the employees that was in a I was going to say a cantonment. All the employees that were employed within the British Army and other services, they were all perfectly happy. She used to call them just black bastards and all that. They didn't care toots. You didn't really mean it, and they were perfectly happy. And of course, what happened when we left the startup? All these people were unemployed then.
So the relationship between the British soldier and the barrack servants was good, do you think?
Yeah.
There was never any trouble between them?
No. I can't recollect anyhow. I'll give you an instance. Our Sergeant Farrier, who of course you must know was responsible for the shoeing of the horses and ailments and things like that, he was a bit of a character. He had a syce there, and his job was pressing the old forge up and down, keeping it hot for the shoes, helping him generally. And he used to call him all the black bastards you could lay your tongue to. Treat him like that. But he thought a bit about him, just to say, on the quiet, he looked after him. And when we moved from Chimelgilly, this chappie, he came with us to Kirky, and when we left Kirky, he came with us to Jansey. I wouldn't mind betting after I left when they went to Moore, but he went with them to Moore as well. He wouldn't leave him. Wherever he went, and the family, don't forget.
Did any of the British soldiers keep in contact with their servants after they'd gone back to England?
No, I shouldn't imagine so. They're a bit too low for that, and they weren't in a position to do so. They weren't educated, they couldn't read or write or anything like that. As I say, when they drew the pay, I had to put the thumbprint on the pay book. But then there was other employees in the officers' mess, sergeant's mess, NCO's mess. They were a cut above the others. And then, of course, is the canteen. I mean, that was owned by Indians, governed by them financially and all that. But of course, they used to have to work closely with the commanding officer.
What type of things could you buy from the canteen?
I can only remember two things. Food and drink, beer. I suppose you could, or tea, char and wads, of course. I can't remember any other commodities. I suppose you got soap and razor blades and things like that from there.
Could we say something about your commanding officers in Chimelgarry and in India generally? Can you remember who they were?
Strange to say, I can remember at least three of them.
Who were they?
Whereas, more recently, just for the war this summer, I can't remember. Yet I can remember these over 50 years ago. My commanding officer at the time at Chimelgarry was Major Brevet Lieutenant Colonel Charles Edward Boyce, B-O-Y-C-E. Now, my battery had rather a bad reputation at the time. I don't know why, really, except for quite a bit of VD and bad discipline, several of them getting sent to detention. And once they had detention at Secunderabad, they didn't want a second dose. I've seen some tough guys go there, and I've admitted they didn't want to go back there again. And that, of course, no comparison to today. And anyhow, Major Boyce went the right way about things. He did it shortly after I'd joined it. He paraded the battery and he told them, "I've been sent here to smarten you up. You've got a bad name." Now, he said, there's two ways of doing it. You can have an easy time or you can have a hard time. It's entirely up to you. I'm not trying to quote his exact exact words, of course. But he said, the other point is, if I don't smarten you up, I get a bowler hat. And he said, I don't want a bowler hat. So you can guess I'm going to smarten you up. But it's entirely up to you whether you have an easy time or a bad time. Put your guts into it. Get a good report on practice camp. See, once a year we used to have a practice camp where we used to go out, fire the guns, and the big shots up there, the generals and that, watching the performance, see how we performed, and we get a good report on practice camp. He said, I'll see you have an easy time after it. All right, he spoke to the men straight to the point, and they got down to brass tacks. They put their heart into it. We went on practice camp, and we got a good report. Everybody was happy. A bit different to the colonel we got later on at Jansey. I forget his name. Maybe it's just as well. But he was a sod. He was too much of a martinet. He went the wrong way about it. When he joined us at Jansey, and this was in my last 12 months or so, fortunately, he paraded all the senior NCOs in the sergeant's mess. And instead of speaking to them like Colonel Boyce did, incidentally, he was a brigadier down Woodage when I was on my kickstep course. I met him then. And instead of speaking to him like Major Boyce did, he said, I'm not satisfied. And if your face doesn't fit, you're out. Roughly speaking, that's what he said. That didn't encourage anybody. So, one officer shot himself. The adjutant resigned his commission. And all the senior NCOs, who were quite happy to soldier in India, and they'd been out there 6 years and over, they put him to be posted to the home establishment, to England, which I did at the end of the following year.
Which year was this?
Well, when I came home, it was 1930.
It was 1930 that you had this trouble with this colonel?
Well, it would be about 19... Near enough, isn't it? I can estimate about middle of 1928, something like that. I'll give you a couple of instances of him. I forget his name. I don't want to be held up for libel, anything like that.
You won't.
But he was a git. Now, at that time, in Jansey, we had a 24-hour guard. We had the barrack square. At the top, there's the row of officers, including the colonel's office. At the bottom was the guard's room, and when the orderly officer came round to turn the guard out, you never knew, of course, when it was going to be, 2 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, any hour he used to come round. We had the sentry would have to shout, guard turn out, as soon as they saw the orderly officer come in, you see. Guard turn out. They used to have to double down about a dozen steps, jump over a dike, which is pretty deep too, if you missed your step, jump over that, form up. On the extreme right, of course, would be the orderly trumpeter. Then there'd be the guard commander and the other sentries. Now, after he'd inspected the guard, the NCO in charge of the guard would retake his place on the right of the guard. The orderly officer would say, right, dismiss the guard. Now then, the NCO had to take six paces forward, turn, leapt about, and shout to the guard, "Sentry, rejoin your post." Because the sentry had also come down, you see, to form up with the others. He would have to about turn and take his post on the veranda. So then he would have to say, "Guard, into the guard room, dismiss." Guys, you might get a new bombardier up from one of the other stations. A bit new, young bombardier. First thing he'd do, of course, is take six paces forward about to guard in the guard room, dismiss. Forget to repost his sentry onto the veranda. No excuses. He'd go up in front of the colonel and get a reprimand for it. Things like that. Now then, he'd sit in his office, he'd have his watch there, and every call which was sounded by the orderly trumpeter who were on guard, he'd look at his watch. And if he was a minute out, send for the guard commander, give him a severe rip. He was instrumental in me buying an Oyster Rolex watch. I've got it in there now. 1928. That's right, 1928 when he came.
To make sure you were on time.
Yeah. I had the Illustrated London Times in the mess, and it was advertising this Oyster Rolex watch showing Jabez Wolf. I think he was the first man, or one of the first, to swim the channel. And he was wearing an Oyster Rolex watch. Waterproof, dustproof, and all the other proofs. Guaranteed not to vary more than a minute a month. And in India, with the climate, he had a job to get a good watch. You see? And if I remember right, it cost roughly £6. Now, £6 was a lot of money, you know. I was a bombardier at the time, pay sergeant, doing pay sergeant, and so was another bombardier, also doing pay sergeant, in the 72nd Battalion. We were both sent for one. He's varied a minute a month, he sent it back. Mine was the battery timekeeper for the rest of my 2 years there, and I've worn it for everything you can think of. Firing rifles, firing guns, digging trenches, any heavy work.
So it was simply because of this colonel that you'd gone to all this trouble to get such a good watch.
Yes.
This was the kind of regime which he'd created in Jhansi. And you actually said that an officer had committed suicide. Was this because of the way this colonel was behaving?
That's all we could think of. Actually, I was away at Delhi at the time, and when we came back, Captain Paddy Pratt had shot himself. He went out on the Mayadam, put a shotgun in his mouth and pulled the trigger. I did have a photo of his funeral, but I've told you I can't find this album with all the old photos in.
So at this time in Jhansi, in 1928, under this colonel, there was some bad leadership. Was this the only time that you had bad leadership in India? Or were there other instances where...
the only time we had leadership like that. Mm. Like everything else, you can go to the extremes, you see. There's another point. It was pretty hot in Jhansi, 110 in the shade. And the bungalows... we had no doors, we had the door space. We used to have couscous tatties.
That was what were they?
Rushes. Hanging down like grass. The cleaning boys, the chicos, used to have to throw water on them. So the wind coming in would blow the cool air in. You see? And we didn't have those in Simulgurry. It wasn't quite so hot there, but we used to have the punkawallas sitting there during the night. We had one with a poor fella, a big club foot. He used to be sitting on his haunches there, pulling. And then he'd doze off, and somebody was shouting to me, "Kinchkaroy, you black bastard!" You see, there's something been doing the sleep.
What was it? Kinchkaroy?
Pull.
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 Kinchkaroy.
Kinchkaroy. And, alright.
What about these tatters? They were to cool the air coming into the barracks.
Yes.
Yeah.
You see, you throw the water, the cold water, on the couscous tatties, and the air coming through would blow the cool air into the bungalow, you see. And in Jansi, it was pretty hot. And when we went to Jansi, we had to wear spine pads, like a pad which you put over your spine. Keep the heat from it.
A cloth pad?
Yes. Just about that wide, 6 inches wide roughly. It's going covering your spine. Because I think they've discovered it wasn't your head that got your sunstroke, it was the spine. Anyhow, we weren't allowed out of barracks after between 2 and 4. It's so hot, confined to your bungalows. But this colonel decided that the white man had to do stableman down the lines looking after the horses in the afternoon. One of them got heat stroke, and I can visualise him now dying in the hospital because I happened to be in there with malaria at the time. I got out of my bed, walked along the veranda and looked in the room, saw this poor devil dying of heat stroke.
And so he'd got heat stroke because of the orders of this colonel.
Yeah, that's my opinion. And he defeated his own object. He ruined, he was a good brigade at the time, he ruined it with his attitude, his martinet business. And most unreasonable. You see, his best NCOs and that left him. Now, as a guard myself, I'd been there 4 years. I decided to come home on a payment leave. I saved up for it.
But how much did you have to save?
£25. This is a lot of money then. And, alright, I saved up the £25. No smoking, no drinking, no gambling, no nothing. In other words, we shaved upwards, as we called it. And I put in for payment leave. But our battery commander at the time was Captain Paddy Pratt, one I've just told you about, who shot himself later on. God knows why. I mean, he was all right financially, he had no mess bills unpaid, which was a great thing. But he had heinous offence in those days, if you didn't pay your mess bills. You know, the old Victorian era, it was still in force, of course, and they had the officers, and the officers' mess. Nothing, he was all right financially, all the accounts in the battery and everything was okay. And he was a steady going old stick, he used to smoke his pipe, but he liked to drink. And, of course, we were waiting for a major to come at the time. But Paddy was the battery commander, and I was bombardier, I was doing bay sergeant. Oh, he says, "No hot food," he says. "We've got nobody to take your place." I said, "I can train somebody, I've got a bombardier gold." I said, "He'll be all right." "Oh, no," he says, "he relied on me 100%. So he said, "Look, Horsfield," he said, "you forfeit it this month. I'll promise you it faithfully next year." Because you only allowed it during the trooping season, you see. And as I say, I forget that. I think it was January to April, something like that. And so I wasn't very pleased about it. So they didn't see me for 4 days. I was mostly down the NCO's mess and blew the lot in, with the assistance of a couple of friends, of course. And then I started to save up again. Now, by the time the next trooping season had arrived round, which was January 1930, Captain Paddy Platt had shot himself, and we'd got a new battery commander, he came from an old artillery family, Major A.B. Van Straubenzie. He was a good soldier, good battery commander. He was too good. He wanted me for everything. Now don't forget, I was an ex-trumpeter, and I was the kind of man they expected and looked forward to in years to come getting the warrant officers from. He didn't get commissions those days like you do these days. Very, very, they sort of encouraged me, but they gave me too much. You wanted me to do too much. At the time, I was number one of headquarters, much more to do than what the sergeants did. I was also battery commander's assistant. In other words, I was with him at the observation post, helping him to block the lines of fire and angle of sight and things like that, control the fire. I was also pay sergeant. I was doing pay sergeant, so I asked to go back to duty. I got number one of headquarters. I was playing hockey 3 or 4 times a week. I was studying for my first class certificate of education in the evening, always in your spare time, not in the daytime. And I was down with malaria every other day. I'll tell you a bit about the malaria after. I cured myself.